Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I guess technically we are still in the throes of the spring of sorrow. I want to check in and just make sure that Triple Threat has us on schedule for the Summer of Joy, which will commence on June 21st, the official first day of summer.
And I did buy you the T-shirt, by the way. I got you the Summer of Joy T-shirt.
Wonderful. I'm sure it will be very popular this summer.
Yeah.
Sarcastically, yesterday night at about 10:30, mass shooting outside the McDonald's on State and Chicago Avenue, right in the heart of River North. 10 shot, 2 dead, 1 reportedly in custody. That's just 10:30 on a Thursday night in the middle of May in Chicago.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
So I know the curfew went into effect at Millennium Park last night. Maybe you're going to have to extend the perimeter beyond Millennium Park. Not that this was necessarily unaccompanied minors, but if you saw any of the news coverage and the chaotic scene outside of that McDonald's, it wasn't just the mass shooting that occurred and people scrambling. Then there, when police did show up, there were subsequent fights breaking out, people running around. It was, something out of a third world country, which is what Chicago is increasingly looking like on a daily basis, something out of a third world country.
Yeah, police don't know the motive at this time, but they do have somebody in custody. But, I mean, this is one of the reasons why Ken Griffin is talking about leaving Chicago if the violence doesn't stop. And who's going to be with him when they leave?
Forget Ken Griffin. This regular people are fleeing Chicago, including, by the way, I hasten to add this over and over again, the depopulation of black residents of Chicago from Chicago. Oh, rich white people leaving. No. I mean, yes, but not only. Everybody who can get out is trying to, because why? Because law-abiding people want the same thing regardless of race. Here is one young woman who was on scene last night outside that McDonald's.
We walked across the street to the store. Next thing you know, people start shooting, and everybody just got hit. My first instinct was just run, because I've been hit before. So it's like, coming down here doing all this nonsense is not necessary at all, because look what just happened. Now all of y'all hit, hurt in the hospital, when all y'all want to do is enjoy yourselves.
The most telling thing about that statement, I've been hit before. She knows what it's like to be shot. She knows what to do when the shooting breaks out. This is just something that she has become desensitized to, the way that we have become desensitized to the violence and to the body count in general. It's a sad commentary. Bill and Glenn Allen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, last night on the news, I heard a report that the police are going to start using metal detector wands on people at Millennium Park.
Yeah, they set up a gate.
When did stop and frisk become popular again? I thought that was unconstitutional and all of that. You know, if they just did that for the last 5 or 6 years, they might not have the murder capital of the country. You know, but now I guess it's okay that the criminals from the South and West Sides are going to the popular rich Democrat areas now. So,
thanks for the call, Bill. Looks like they're entering Great America or something. I mean, they put this metal gate, around Millennium Park, and you can only enter at certain locations, and you have to get wanded down, and then they check your bags. It's ridiculous to go see take a picture in front of the bean, but then they take it down Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, then put it back up for Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I mean, that's her solution, and some people are okay with it, some aren't.
That's a good idea, especially, you know, like, Chicago is dangerous.
I guess it's just a reaction, right? Like, you feel like you have to do something. You know, if they don't do anything to, like, stop crime, then people are going to get upset. So I guess it's kind of just a way to show they're trying to do something. But I don't think it will actually do anything.
I love the idea, and I love that they're doing it. And they should have been doing this. Chicago is very dangerous.
Yeah, the woman that you heard there saying, you know, they feel the need to do something, and it's not going to do anything. That's the one sensible a person that you heard in that montage.
It looks right. Ridiculous. I mean, anybody in the world, why would you be a tourist in Chicago?
Well, forget tourism. In terms of, does this enhance public safety? You're chasing. Here's where something, you're fighting the last war, as it were. Here's where something bad happened on Saturday night, so here's where we'll do something public. Okay, well then, are you going to have a curfew at State in Chicago at 6 p.m. from Thursday to Sunday now because of the mass shooting last night? You're chasing. You're not doing anything substantial. There's no strategic thinking. There's no tactics that are being deployed consistent with strategic thinking for a citywide approach to public safety. There's no incorporation of all of the principles here with the criminal justice system, the mayor, the Cook County State's attorney, the sheriff's office to some extent, obviously the chief judge. There's none of that. There's press release politics. Throw up a metal detector. Let's have a police presence on Millennium Park so people still talking about Millennium Park from last weekend won't be talking about it this weekend. Okay, well then what do you do with the next hotspot and the next one after that and after that and after that? Pete in Milwaukee.
Good morning. Say, I'm on board with you guys like 99.5% of the time, but they've got to do something. So if they set up perimeters and you go through the gate and they check with a metal detector to see if you're carrying a gun to look at your bags, they do that at football games, baseball games, they do it at the airport. They got to start somewhere. So if you don't want them to do that, where do they start at? Just shooting people, profiling? And I get it. I think every guy that's carrying a gun that's a threat should be shot if he pulls his gun out. But they got to start somewhere, guys.
Okay. They got to start somewhere. As I said, the starting point is that you're doing something that is enhancing the peace citywide, or you're doing something that is bringing resources to bear comprehensively where you have consistent incidents of violent crime. That's not what's happening here. So if you are intent on committing crimes, or if you're intent on going down to the city with a bunch of other people, then so you don't go to Millennium Park. You think that's the only place to congregate?
No, but I mean, people are going to take prom pictures there and things. Now you got to go through a private security that the mayor hired, that they're unarmed, by the way. To get into the park,
right,
and wait
private
in line
security.
Like everybody. I mean, it's just whatever
private
freedom
security.
Of movement. Just walk around. We can't, you know. It's not anything that
right.
Chicago
private
would
security
find
is right. Bad for the neighborhoods. It's very concerning to triple threat when the
Bucktown
residents of Bucktown or the residents of other neighborhoods hire private security to augment the safety in their neighborhoods. But it's fine when she does it from Millennium Park.
Yeah.
Got it.
Hypocrite.
Alex in Hinsdale.
Hi, good morning, guys. Two comments. They just came out with the hotel occupancy rates after COVID, and Chicago was dead last out of any major U.S. city of occupancy rates. People aren't coming back. And the second thing is that it's like putting your finger in a hole in a dam by security checks at Millennium. It may look good, something's happening. It won't make one bit of difference to the safety of Chicago. Thanks,
That's
guys.
Right. Thanks, Alex. Yeah, that's right.
It's just going to push the violence to other neighborhoods.
Randy and Sandwich.
Like it did last night.
I think this seems by design. I've watched this deterioration of Chicago in particular, but other major cities for several years now. And I'm wondering if there's a bigger motive here in regards to if you get people to flee out of Chicago that always vote Democrat or in other areas that always vote Democrat, and you push them into other areas, well, now you've essentially made those other areas purple counties, purple cities, states, whatever, because you've made all the badness leave one area in some regards, and then it goes to another area and affects those elections. I wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
Thanks for the call, Randy. I mean, some of the flight from the city changed some of the region over the last 30 years, I would say, when you had a move from the city, yuppies moving from the city to the North Shore, that changed the North Shore from country club Republican to Marxist. But I think that's sort of past post at this point. I mean, where you have people fleeing to the south suburbs from the south side. Well, the south suburbs is a demilitarized zone. What's the difference? You have people dispersing to many different states, but those are disproportionately center-right voters, I would posit. So no, I don't think so. I don't think it's by design in terms of some sort of electoral strategy. I think it's just the direct result of the ideology of the people in charge. Ideological identitarians, anti-police, anti-incarceration, and this is what you get. I think it's sort of an Occam's razor discussion. Look at the ideology of the people in charge, how that translates into the policies that they pursue, how it translates into the jobs they're doing and how they're doing them. We can all see it. And that explains why you have a city that's up for grabs and why the spring of sorrow will not transition to the summer of joy.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Professor Joshua Katz, one of the leading classics professors in the country, who is at Princeton for now, but the president of Princeton University has asked the board to terminate Joshua Katz as a professor there. Unusual occurrence: a tenured professor getting fired. And it's interesting because we talk about this quite a bit, the idea that legal norms be part of our cultural norms, even where they're not technically required. For example, due process. Private institution, not technically required, but it's our sense that if you apply these legal norms to yourselves, you communicate that you're a fair institution, that the leadership of the institution is fair, that you're truth seekers, you're not operating capriciously. Well, at Princeton, I should say, in the legal system, criminal justice system, double jeopardy does not apply. Double jeopardy does apply. In other words, you can't be tried for the same crime twice. At Princeton, that is not the case. You absolutely can be tried for the same offense twice, and that's what's happened to Joshua Katz. And the question is why. So Katz was investigated and punished in 2018 for a consensual relationship he had with a student about a decade ago. He was suspended without pay for a year. Right. He retained his professorship and moves on. Not so fast. over the last several years, he has taken to publicly criticizing the identitarian politics on campus, including as practiced by the president of the university. So, for example, he criticized the awarding of extra sabbatical time for minority professors at Princeton, as well as course relief, summer salary. He said, he wrote at the time, "It boggles my mind that anyone would advocate giving people, extraordinarily privileged people already, let me point out, Princeton professors, extra perks for no reason other than their pigmentation." Yeah. The president of the university, a man named MacGruber, he objected personally and strongly to Katz's statement. Katz has also made other statements, and this is maybe where your recollection gets refreshed, because we've talked about him and some of the statements he made, given his standing as a leading professor in the classics at a leading, ostensibly a leading university in the country, used to be. He's made statements in opposition to other identitarian politics, to the rioting that punctuated the summer of 2020 and so forth. And so now they've revisited the consensual relationship he had with the student a decade ago, and the recommendation is that he be terminated, not because he committed fraud, not because there has been any new determination of or characterization of the relationship in question, but just because.
Well, they want him out, so they're trying to, you know, dig up everything they can.
He doesn't agree with the school's statement that it's systemically racist. His lawyer, Samantha Harris, said that if expressing an unpopular opinion is an invitation to have your personal life turned inside out looking for damaging evidence, how many people are going to be willing to speak out? A supporter of Katz's, co-founder of Princetonians for Free Speech. This is a Princeton alumni. "If a faculty member or student says something that contradicts our orthodoxy, we will get you. If not for what you said, then by twisting your language, by using extensive resources of the university to shame you before the student body, and by investigating your personal life for years past." Yeah, that's what they've done. So how do you receive that? 312-642-5600, Turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, Turnkey.pro text line. Is that important to you? Do you think that has implications beyond Princeton, beyond the Ivy League, beyond the college campus?
I mean, does he really want to keep his job there after the way they've been treating him, too?
Well,
is it time to move on?
Well, that's where do you move on to?
Yeah, can't go to Harvard. Hey, what about a Big Ten school? No, I'm sorry. I'm not making light of it, but I mean, at some point in time in your life, you've got to decide, am I going to sit here and, you know, be harassed and, you know, have a witch hunt after me, or am I going to change professions? Or I'm just going to, you know, and then, I don't know, do you cave or do you fight? Stay and fight. I mean, obviously, it's staying in a fight because he's hired an attorney.
And then the school, I mean, there is one wrinkle between the 2018 investigation and the 2021 investigation. The undergraduate that he had the relationship with, formerly undergraduate, she did not participate in the 2018 investigation. She did participate in the 2021 inquiry, and then she decided that she had been sexually harassed.
Oh, so she changed her, or she didn't recall at the time, but then years later she recalled that she was sexually harassed. Uh-huh. Or did somebody get to her, Dan?
And campus activists, of course, say that Professor Katz's classroom is not a safe place.
Not a safe place. Oh, mm-hmm. There are those buzzwords again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. the Title IX coordinator.
Oh, I love Title IX.
At Princeton, found that cats did not violate the school's harassment policies. Conduct must be, among other things, unwelcome in order to constitute sexual harassment. That was in a report that she provided in the case. Both Katz and his student, quote, were willing and active participants in the relationship. Accordingly, I'm dismissing the formal complaint with respect to sexual harassment. But that didn't stop at the office of the dean of faculty from finding other violations, claiming Katz hadn't been fully forthcoming. He had discouraged the undergraduate from receiving therapy, which is a charge that Katz denied, and so forth. Anyway, it's a case where double jeopardy that applies in a criminal setting, that's one of our due process legal norms, does not apply at one of the leading universities in the country, and you're likely to see one of the great classics professors in the country out of a gig, and probably out of academia, too hot to handle. This isn't political at all, the story of David Sabatini that was really well put together by Susie Weiss over at Barry Weiss's Substack, Common Sense. The fall of David Sabatini, who is considered perhaps the leading molecular biologist in the world.
Wow.
Tenured professor at MIT. Ran a major lab at the Whitehead Institute, overseeing a team of 39 researchers, postdocs, and technicians. Their job was to disentangle the mystery of mTOR, of the mTOR signaling pathway, a protein Sabatini had discovered while still in medical school at Johns Hopkins. The mTOR signaling pathway plays a critical role in tumor developments. Figuring out how it works could go a long way to saving countless lives. Literally, you're talking about a guy who is
a world-renowned cancer researcher.
Yeah, the tip of the spear in terms of finding a cure for cancer or some cancers.
Yeah, now he's collecting unemployment.
John in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, as you say, that one professor that they went back 10 years, if Princeton's policy is that they're going to go back 10 years and look at everybody on campus, at janitors, everybody on campus, then okay. If not, this professor has a very good lawsuit that he's going to hopefully win millions.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, but is that enough? Is extracting millions from the billions in Princeton's endowment or insurance fund, does that change anything at Princeton, in the Ivy League, on college campuses, in American culture? David Sabatini did not make political statements. But on the night of April 18th, 2018, after an evening of whiskey tasting, he's a bit of a whiskey aficionado, according to Ms. Weiss, he and another researcher named Kristen Nose had sex. Nose was an incoming cancer researcher at the Whitehead Institute, where she would also had her own lab. He was 50, she was 29. He had split with his wife and was in the process of getting a divorce. And so they saw each other casually. They both agreed that this was something that was casual. And some of the comments of Naus, the female, suggest that she had other casual relationships
with
of a sexual
people.
Nature that she wanted to maintain. Okay. But then in August 2018, the Whitehead Institute adopted a new consensual sexual and romantic relations policy, which stated that lab heads couldn't have a consensual or sexual relationship with any coworkers. Sabatini says not going to HR right then was my critical mistake. Okay, he made a mistake in terms of not disclosing,
right,
given the new policy, but that's after the fact. At the time, Sabatini didn't think it mattered much. He and this woman were still close, and they were still texting, communicating. She wanted the relationship to continue. He was sort of souring on it, and there's some text messages that suggest as much, that Weiss, the reporter here, spoke to Sabatini, obviously, spoke to lawyer for Nauss, spoke to a bunch of their respective colleagues in these research positions. In late summer, early fall of 2020, during the pandemic, something changed. Nauss texted her friend she was, quote, unpacking a ton of suppressed abuse and trauma from an obvious local source, unquote, which was a reference to Sabatini. Her fellowship at the Institute was ending. She didn't apply for any faculty jobs there. When the new director, a woman named Ruth Lehman, called to ask why she wasn't applying for a faculty job, she complained for the first time of being harassed.
Oh, no.
In November of 2020, she warned her friend, an incoming fellow at this institute, to, quote, squeeze out as much advice as possible before your mentor is Weinsteined out of science. Talking about Sabatini. Then, at the new director's behest, the consulting firm Jones Diversity sent the Whitehead employees a survey based in part on Nauss's false complaint about Sabatini, according to a complaint later brought by Sabatini. All participants were anonymous. Five or so of the nearly 40 employees in Sabatini's lab took part. Two former Sabatini lab members lodged complaints to HR about the alleged bro culture in the lab. So then the Institute hired a law firm to conduct an investigation on gender bias and or inequities and a retaliatory leadership in the lab that Sabatini ran. Sabatini was never told what he was accused of. Another violation of our due process norms.
There's a Sixth Amendment right.
Former lab members told Susie Weiss, the reporter here, their coworkers were sobbing when they came out of the meetings with lawyers, saying the lawyers had put words in their mouths. They had a very strong agenda, one of them told her. In retrospect, Weiss writes, it was already over for this once-in-a-generation scientist. A year and a half later, August of 2021, the lawyers finished their 248-page report. A few days later, Sabatini was at home when he got the email from the Institute with the report attached. Then a meeting with Ms. Lehman, the director now, appeared on his calendar. She never met with him one-on-one. She never met one-on-one with the most famous person on her payroll. And he knew what was up. Talked to his lawyers, and they told him he was about to be fired. MIT then put him on administrative leave. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute, that funds biomedical research and was paying Sabatini's salary, fired him. He resigned from the Whitehead Institute and eventually MIT. Soon the biotech startups he'd helped found, Navitor Pharmaceuticals, KSQ, Raise Therapeutics, started severing their relationships with him.
Oh.
Sabatini was axed from professorships, fellowships, and professional societies. Awards and grants were pulled. His income disappeared. I lost everything. My whole life imploded. I became a shell of what I was. He stopped sleeping at home so he didn't have to hear the FedEx envelopes plopping down on his doormat, invariably another letter from another institution cutting ties with him. He toggled between his brother's home. His brother is a professor of neurobiology, runs his own lab at Harvard Medical School. Jeez, the Sabatini boys.
Oh, smart.
Toggled between his brother's home and his ex-wife's, stopped eating and sleeping, went on unemployment, dropped 35 pounds in 3 months, cried a lot, his hair was falling out. A friend of Sabatini told me, the reporter, he sent Sabatini articles about the mTOR pathway he was researching to keep him preoccupied. So what was in that 248-page report? Chiefly, it was failing to disclose his consensual relationship with the woman, Miss Nauss, even though it was a policy that was instituted after the fact.
Yeah, I mean,
and then there's this other manufactured silliness about the lab environment and his personality and how his personality led to favoring some versus others, that is rejected by so many of the colleagues of his that Ms. Weiss talked to. The baffling to everyone I spoke to, nine of Sabatini's current and former lab employees, a current faculty member at the Whitehead Institute, a half a dozen top doctors and scientists in his field, most of them would not speak on the record for fear of being associated with Sabatini and derailing their own careers. It's impossible to be honest about this and preserve your own skin, quote, says a scientist who recently worked under Sabatini. A trainee called the report's depiction of the lab an alternate reality and the characterization of Sabatini as retaliatory or in any way unfair, quote, deeply insane, unquote. They have the wrong guy, a female scientist who knows Sabatini and Naus told Susie Weiss, the reporter. A friend of his who runs NYU Medical School said, you know, somebody will pick you up in Russia, China, somewhere where this stuff doesn't matter.
does he want to go to Russia or China?
So he said to her, well, what about NYU? So they went through a process of onboarding him to NYU, but word of that got out.
Oh, yeah. And the mob. Pictures right now. There they are.
And the mob descended at NYU, pressuring Ken Langone, Langone Medical School there, a billionaire founder, co-founder of Home Depot, pressuring them and the president of NYU Medical School to ultimately withdraw or to ultimately publicly state that they would not be hiring Sabatini.
I mean, people are standing there with "Say No to Sabatini" signs and a sign that says "Gross," and Sabatini with a circle around it, an X through it, or a line through
it.
In
addition to that, because of her crime of initiating a conversation with Sabatini that potentially would have led to him being hired, now the president of the NYU Medical School is under scrutiny from the same mob and the same institutions that are looking at her and reviewing the grant funding that the school gets from NIH and so forth. David Sabatini and Joshua Katz, if you think this resides only in the hallowed halls of academia and high-level scientific research, then you don't know what's happening in America right now.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was a fun exchange. Senator Josh Hawley and Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. Josh Hawley wanted to know what the Energy Secretary and, by extension, the Biden administration is doing to reduce gas prices, to increase the supply of oil, to reduce gas prices. This as something that literally was a Babylon Bee story,
yeah,
is now happening. The Babylon Bee had a story suggesting that gas stations were now adding a digit to their signage at the gas station so they could prepare for $10 gasoline. Washington gas station, one Washington gas station is adding a digit. The 76 gas station in Auburn, Washington, has been reprogrammed. The gas pumps there have been reprogrammed to make room for double-digit pricing. They only had, you know, one place to the left of the decimal point. Now they got two. To be fair, you know, J.P. Morgan says $6 gas come $10, August.
Yes. Yeah.
They're preparing for $10 gas in D.C. Here's Hawley and Granholm. Hawley was a bit frustrated with the answers he was getting, as you can imagine.
that now AAA is projecting that gas prices will hit a national average of $6 a gallon by the month of August. Is this acceptable to you?
No, it is not. Oh, and you can thank the activity of Vladimir Putin for invading Ukraine and pulling essentially those barrels.
With all due respect, Madam Secretary, that's utter nonsense. In January of 2021, the average gas price in my state was $2.07. 8 months later, long before Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine, that price was up over 30%, and it has been going up consistently since. What are you doing to reverse this administration's policies that are drawing down our own supply of energy in this country, that are throttling oil and gas production in the United States of America? What are you doing about
it? With respect, sir, it is not administration policies that have affected supply and demand.
How can you say that when the price of gas was up over 30% from January to...
answer
my questions. And it's my time, Madam Secretary, so why don't you answer my question? From January to August, the price of gasoline was up over 30%. In my state alone, it has been a continuous upward tick since then. And here's what your president did when he first came to office. He immediately reentered the Paris Climate Accord. He canceled the Keystone Pipeline. He halted leasing programs in ANWR. He issued a 60-day halt on all new oil and gas leases and drilling permits on federal lands and waters. That's nationwide. That accounts, by the way, for 25% of U.S. oil production. He directed federal agencies to eliminate all supports for fossil fuels. He imposed new regulations on oil and gas and methane emissions. Those were all just in the first few days. Are you telling me that's had no effect on our energy supply?
94% of the oil and gas executives that were surveyed by the Dallas Fed said that administration policies had nothing to do with the increase in the price of oil.
I'm not interested in opinions of these people. I'm interested in the facts. Are you telling me that these policies had no effect? Is that your testimony that these policies had no effect? Are you telling me, Madam Secretary, are you telling me under oath that these policies had no effect?
I'm telling you that 94% of the oil and gas industry...
I'm not interested in their opinion. I'm interested in the facts.
So, no, they did not. Ask Vladimir
Putin. That is a remarkable statement.
It is, and the 94%, this is like the 98% of climatologists believe that climate change is a threat to the planet, whatever. These stilted surveys that come up, you've heard any number of oil and gas company execs who've taken to the airwaves on CNBC, reports that have been done. We've played some of their statements here that specifically point to administration policies as having the preponderant impact on the rise in gas prices. So, you know, Granholm, this is the, you know, 18 Nobel Prize winning economists say that it's a good idea to pass $5 trillion more in funny money spent to raise capital gains and corporate taxes. You know, you can always find a few politicized participants in any sector to lean on for political cover, which is what Granholm and this administration are doing. It is preposterous. It's a remarkable statement, and it's a nonsensical one. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, who is a Fox Business analyst, as well as the proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Granholm went on to say, we're doing a lot of things. We're releasing a million barrels a month from the strategic from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and we're also imploring both domestic producers and international producers to supply more. Is that enough?
Well, here's what just stands out to me in the whole thing is the humility of the administration is that, like, their success here, they made it abundantly clear that they were going to disrupt the fossil fuel industry. And the senator didn't even mention one of the most serious things is the discussion of bills to limit access to credit markets for anyone involved in fossil fuel. Remember when they did that a couple months ago? And it happened to be the same month the same week that they called the big oil producers and said, hey, why are you guys producing more oil? But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that this is what they ran on. They said they were going to do this, and this is all part of trying to achieve their green energy utopia that's somewhere 20 years in the future. So why aren't they proud of it? Why are they pointing fingers at Vladimir Putin when they've done exactly what they said? To reiterate what the senator said, canceled leases, canceled permits, canceled the pipeline, limit access to credit markets. We were producing 13 million barrels of oil a day in February of 2020. Right now we're producing 11.5 million barrels per day. We're consuming over 20 million barrels per day. But if you're going to look for why we're producing less, why wouldn't you look to the party that said we're going to force these companies to produce less? It seems like that'd be the first place to look for clues as to what's happened. And to her, this is the mildest defense I can give to her, that some of the costs for producing have gone up, which, by the way, is also partly the federal government's fault for increasing the money supply by 40% over the last year and a half. For her to say, and she never really said that they weren't responsible, she just kept deflecting. It's easy to get opinions of people when you threaten them, it seems like to me.
Yeah, right.
So, Stockholm Syndrome is real in this case, it seems like. So, and when you crush any dissent. So that I was like tired and hadn't had my coffee this morning until I heard that interview, and now like my hands are shaking, I want in.
But they're doing this because they want everyone to be forced to eventually buy electric cars, right?
Right. Yeah, why don't they say it out loud?
Right.
We know it. We heard them say it initially, but now that it's getting a little sweaty and people are saying, wow, it's costing me too much money, now they're shying away from it. This is their great victory. Why aren't they just standing on the pulpit and saying, we have made gas prices this high and we're going to force you to buy electric cars? Oh, but too bad the guy who makes the electric cars no longer subscribe to their ideology. That might be a little bit of a curveball for them as well.
Well, speaking of that guy, Elon Musk, it was interesting this week, the S&P ESG index, the environmental social governance metric to measure these companies by, you know, to socially responsible investing and all that jazz, they kicked Tesla off their index, and Musk made the point Exxon is on your index, but I'm not. They say, despite the fact that he has some input or some relevance to the electric car market, some relevance, Tesla is the dominant player. They have the most market share in that market. But so they kick him off. Exxon's on there, but it's two things. One, it's a comment on this ESG crowd. Also, it's a comment on the oil companies, because I don't want people to think because we're promoting policies that would lead to more energy production to reduce the energy costs for Americans and the cost of doing business for American companies, that somehow I'm a big fan of Exxon or these big oil companies, because I'm not. They shouldn't be getting subsidies. They're largely woke, particularly in the C-suite. So it has nothing to do with any sort of partisan or philosophical affinity to these companies versus the other companies, because to some extent what you're seeing is in corporate America, the left cannibalizing the left.
No doubt. Well, you know, we're from Chicago, so I think it's easier for us to spot a grift than some people in other places. And the ESG thing just absolutely smacks at that. What you said about Exxon, I don't have a negative opinion about big oil. Oil is absolutely one of the most, you know, if not the most important commodity that we consume here. Transportation is essential. When you're trying to get to school or get to the hospital, I mean, you're thanking God that we have oil to propel us here. But, and again, Exxon has gotten woke, and I'm sure they have spent huge money on at least pretending they're trying to find alternatives, and that's the problem here. You know, Charlie Munger says, you show me the incentives and I'll show you, you know, where the mistakes are being made, or where the corruption is. And that's why the ESG thing to me doesn't make any sense, because it was poorly cobbled together, doesn't have much oversight, and the incentive is to look like you're doing something over actually doing something. And by the way, the whole the conservation issue, I don't understand why the left has commandeered that movement. If you ever go to a Ducks Unlimited meeting, you see a bunch of conservatives who are very, very interested in conservation. It's literally right in the name. To me, it seems like we need to take that back.
I made the mistake the other day of looking at my 401k.
Whoa. No, don't do it.
Oh, Ow. What was?
You should have called me, Amy. Don't do it.
Oh, I didn't do it the last time in 2008 and took a humongous hit. So stay in or early withdrawal, or what do you recommend?
No, okay, I personally believe that the biggest part of this move is over. I think that when and again, what is happening in the stock market is readjusting to different interest rate environment. Interest rates can't go up significantly and not have it reverberate through other asset classes, and that's what we're seeing in stocks. It's repricing. It's not Vladimir Putin. It's not anything else. It is that the stocks have a specific value compared with what the safe rate is, the safe rate being U.S. Treasury rate, interest rates in general. So it's going down. So what everyone who is our age, and I know I'm a bit older than you, Amy, but everyone remembers the tech bubble and remembers the real estate bubble. And those were not about prices going out of control. What they were about was leverage and positioning going out of control. And I know I say this thing all the time, and I've said it on your show a couple of times, but in the real estate market, when it was reaching its peak, you talked to your brother-in-law who's an electrician who was telling you about the five homes he owned that he was flipping in 6 months after doing a few few repairs on them. That's not happening right now. 18% of the homes bought in the last year and a half were bought by corporate investment interests. They respond differently to a margin call. And that effect, that's in stocks as well. Back in the tech bubble, everybody I knew was borrowing money and buying tech stocks on leverage and getting rich. I don't see that right now. So I see price adjusting, but I don't see the big manic, panicked selling by people who are getting margin calls. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
So speaking of the real estate market, this was an interesting study that was done by a member of the staff of San Francisco Fed, along with a researcher, university researcher out in California. Remote work and home prices. They conclude that the shift to remote work raised aggregate U.S. house prices by 15.1%. In other words, they attribute more than half of the 24% national house price increase since late 2019 to the shift to remote work. Okay. If that's true, then as that shift has settled, what does that mean for home prices, particularly as mortgage rates are going up?
Well, first of all, I don't agree with the statement in general. I do think it mattered and it pushed home prices higher. But again, I mentioned earlier that part of the way they were going to handle the pandemic was to absolutely flood the market with new money. 40% of the money that exists today, M2 money supply, didn't exist 2 years ago. And that was all part of the modern monetary theory thing they did. They thought, okay, we can close down the economy and make everyone whole just by creating these new dollars. So when you see a huge part of the jump in real estate prices is it's really a bit of a illusion. All it is the dollar being weaker. Now, people who trade foreign currency say, well, the dollar's not weak, the dollar's strong. No, it's strong against the euro and the yen, which are engaged in the same sort of nonsense that we're engaged in. So a huge part of the rise in real estate and a huge part of the rise in everything was just a reflection of a weaker dollar based on the fact that there were so many more dollars created and injected into the system. So that's a much bigger aspect of the real estate thing. And again, the real estate thing as well, when we shifted from, you know, originally it was people moving out of cities into, you know, getting more green space. And that happened before the pandemic, and it was accelerated hugely by the pandemic. So when things change, and work from home is part of it, when things change, it's hard to predict where the money is going to end up. And it ended up in real estate, particularly in, you know, certain areas have outperformed huge.
But you don't see that continuing? You see that settling in, or you do see that continuing, or it's going to be uneven?
Like in the real estate market, the thing that happened in 2007 where we broke 40% because people were leveraged up with too many homes, I see the real estate market cooling off. I believe it's already happening. I believe we're a couple of weeks into it, and I think it's cooling off, and I could easily see prices coming back down 5 or 10%. Right now, the houses, still the time from putting on the market to selling is incredibly small. That hasn't changed yet, but inventory is starting to pick up a little bit more. So, you know, interest rates have gone from 3.25% to 5.25%. That's a big deal as far as affordability goes. Prices have gone up 15%, like you said, in just a year's time. So I see the real estate market cooling off. I want to sell the real estate that I own in poor markets. We're trying to in the Chicago area. But I'm keeping real estate in Colorado because I think Colorado is those states that have become like work from home destination states, and I can, you know, some of my daughter's friends, I can name about 8 of them who have moved to Colorado. They can work from anywhere. I'm keeping property there. So I think certain markets are going to do good.
And what about crypto and the bottoming out of that market as well, with Bitcoin now, you know, hovering around 30 grand?
Which is funny. I'm going to have kind of a counter take to Bitcoin. And part of it is that Bitcoin had to adjust to the new rate policy just like every other asset number, particularly because Bitcoin doesn't give you any yield. So if you're getting a 3% yield in the U.S. Treasury, it makes Bitcoin that much less valuable. But I also think one of the things that happened, I don't know if you guys covered that Tether, Luna, stablecoin story that happened a couple of weeks ago. Now, part of that was that Bitcoin was being driven down to kind of see if they'd blink. They did blink. A lot of it was collateralized with Bitcoin, so that dragged Bitcoin down even further. But what I'm going to say is at the end of it is that when you these off-brand nonsense coins, and I didn't know much about Luna and Tether, and I'm glad I didn't, when they start falling, I think it could eventually make the big two, Bitcoin and Ethereum, actually even more valid and more valuable long-term. So I think that if Bitcoin weathers a storm, and it seems to be too, it's still hovering around, what, 29,000-ish, I think, and I still own it, not a lot. I own it as mostly a dollar hedge. But I think ultimately these things are it's weathering the storm pretty good when you look at all the different things that have happened to it.
He is Jim Urio, Fox Business Analyst, owner of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, you guys, for having me. See you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is a fascinating story. You know the Chicago Reader. If you've been around Chicago, Chicagoland, even if you haven't read it, I'm sure you've seen it around. Chicago Reader's always been sort of a hipster, anti-establishment newspaper. Certainly of the left, let's make no mistake. But there was a time when the Reader featured a cross-section of viewpoints on the range of issues facing the city and the country. And when Leonard Goodman bought the Reader for a dollar about 5 years ago, salvaging the paper, taking on the debt, paying the bills, so forth, trying to turn it around, thought that might continue. He certainly thought it would continue, as he was a columnist and wrote many op-eds for the Reader. But then something happened in November of last year. He wrote a piece entitled "Vaxing Our Kids, Why I'm Not Rushing to Get My Six-Year-Old the COVID-19 Vaccine."
Uh-oh.
And you know, as somebody who would be opposed to vaccine mandates on kids and sees no real demonstrable benefit from the vaccine for kids, based on all the people that we've talked to that are
the low
epidemiologists
risk
and microbiologists and scientists and so forth. Despite that, I found his column to be perfectly even-handed. Well-researched. There's not anything I could pick out that I disagree with. Now, that's probably an indictment. If you're of COVIDian left is hearing me say that, it's probably an indictment. But I'm saying what my position is. And in his piece, he develops both sides of the argument with evidentiary support for both sides of the argument as he's trying to process whether this makes sense for his six-year-old daughter.
And he's not, you know, vaccine shaming anybody in this. He just, you know, talks research. Well, he talked about Mexico's health minister, and he just had a variety of resources that he attributed to.
Well, once this got published, and of course this was published with the endorsement of the editor, the mob was set aflame and all hell broke loose, leading ultimately to Leonard Goodman stepping away from the Reader recently. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Len Goodman, Chicago criminal defense attorney, adjunct professor at DePaul University College of Law, and founder of the Leonard Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting. Len Goodman, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Nice to be on. Thank you.
So, you know, give us your what you expected would come from the piece that you wrote on the vaccine and whether or not to get your daughter vaccinated, your six-year-old daughter vaccinated, and what you learned from what did come.
Right. Well, I mean, you gave a nice summary, and I'll, you know, I'll say this was my 21st column that I wrote for the Reader. And I made a point when I wrote columns, you know, as you said, the Reader has a 50-year history of providing a space for dissent. So I tried to write things that would not be welcome in more mainstream papers. So I wrote columns about connection between Jeffrey Epstein and U.S. intelligence. And I wrote columns about persecution of Assange and Manning. I wrote columns about the Obama Foundation's move to privatize 20 acres of the historic lakefront park, cut down 1,000 trees, and build a 235-foot museum tower. I'm sure some of these columns caused some pushback. And as you correctly said, Dan, I think this vaccine column was very down the middle, and I knew it was a controversial topic, and I had discussed it with my editor before, and she had said, well, you know, I think this one's going to be controversial, but I think a lot of parents are going to appreciate having the alternative points of view. And basically, you know, as you correctly said, I included opinions of a growing number of prominent doctors and scientists who believe that healthy kids should not get the vaccine because of the very low risk of severe COVID in kids, and that the vaccines themselves carry risks, many of which are unknown and are coming to be known only recently. And also that the vaccines do very little to stop the spread of COVID. So the column was, you know, it was well-researched. It was fairly, it was balanced. And many parents did reach out and express gratitude to me. I got an enormous number of likes on social media and people just taking the time to reach out to me because many of them, like myself, were facing possible mandates where our kids weren't going to be able to go to school and we're not going to be able to participate in other activities. I've had parents contact me from all over, from the East Coast, from the West Coast, facing these kind of issues. And so they did appreciate having alternative information that you cannot find. Yeah, that's really what I wanted to do, is to just put something out there to make people think about these mandates. And I was shocked at the pushback. I don't even really know where it came from. But
well, so how long after the article was published or that you got some feedback and that you knew that the staff was upset?
Yeah, there was an initial wave of, you know, if the Reader didn't support the article at all. They disabled comments, and they didn't even put it on their own Twitter page. I put it on my Twitter page, and I got an initial pushback, just like, you know, F off kind of stuff. And then I got this wave of love, you know, from like, you know, hundreds of people, parents. And then there was what felt like an organized campaign of just vicious attacks against me personally. So it was pretty quick. I will say that when I initially got these attacks, I talked to my editor and I said, you know, should I respond to these people on Twitter? I'm not really a social media person. And my editor, Karen Hawkins, said, well, you know, your research was bulletproof, so I would encourage you to, you know, stand your ground. And, so then what the Reader did is in response to this pushback, they hired an anonymous editor, I still don't know who the person is, to rewrite my piece, to make the opinions more acceptable to the critics. And they wanted to replace my piece with the rewritten piece. I basically was given two options, replace it or remove it. And that's when the board got involved and said, because the Reader was in transition to becoming not-for-profit, and the board said, independent of me, said, you know, this is BS. We want some assurances that when this becomes a not-for-profit, that it's going to represent all the people of Chicago, not just, you know, a group of like-minded people. And until we get those assurances, we're going to delay the transition. And Reader management refused to deal with the board and decided to just go with the attacks on me, that I was being obstructionist, that I was basically a petulant child that wouldn't admit when I was wrong. And that's basically the strategy that they used. I ended up with protesters outside my house. So it's been quite 5 months.
And so the editor said, stand your ground. The board backed, your column in its original form. And yet this happened. So how did that happen? And by the way, you're the owner of the paper, right. Co-owner.
Well, I'm only a half owner.
Yeah, so, co-owner. Okay, but still.
I stayed out. And my co-owner did not support my position. Which
LZ Higginbottom is the co-owner, who's a name that's famous for pay-to-play politics in Chicago. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, well, he sided with management.
Of course he did.
Staff all sided with their bosses. So it was, you know, I was basically, even though I had the board on my side.
But also your editor. What did your editor say to the, you know, the mob in the newsroom, as it were?
She's kept silent.
I'm not laughing. It's not funny. But yeah. So I mean, you know, I know you're not. I don't know that how you describe yourself, but I know you're not conservative. I know that nobody at the Reader is conservative. I know they loathe people like me, which is fine. But
not as much as they hate people like me. And
I guess
to the left. I'm basically to the left of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Okay. So what's your takeaway from being effectively cannibalized by your people?
It's been an interesting experience. I mean, I've never had so much hate thrown at me, and it does take a toll on you. I'm sure you've experienced this in your life. And, you know, what I will say is it's given me a new appreciation for some of my clients and what they've gone through. I know, I don't know what you all think of, you know, but I'm not even going to mention, but I've had clients that were, you know, that were wrongly smeared in the media for committing horrible crimes that they didn't commit. And so in some ways, maybe it's given me a new empathy for that. But yeah, it's, you know, I don't know. I guess the way I look at it is, you know, I think American people have really lost trust in the media and in their leaders. You know, I think I saw a poll recently that more than 50% don't like either party. And I feel like this is a desperate attempt by people in power to control the narrative. And it's so un-American. I mean, how can you have if you have an issue, an important issue of public health, you know, whether our kids should get the vaccine, and you're going to say we can only hear one side of the debate, only the side that favors Pfizer. It's insane. And for that to happen at the Chicago Reader, which has this history of dissent, the free and freaky reader, it is quite disturbing. And, you know, it says something about our times. And, you know,
it's a story. It's also a story, you know, about where the anti-establishment becomes the establishment, isn't it?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, you would certainly think, you know, some of the people at the Reader that, you know, maybe have been parts of marginalized groups, that they would be embracing dissent. But, you know, that used to be the Democratic Party used to be, you know, the party of free speech. It is no longer. I think you probably are aware, you know, now there's the Disinformation Governance Board that the Department of Homeland Security just came up with.
They're on pause right now, but yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but
because
the fact that
pushback, and, you know, the pushback was from both the left and the right. So, you know, and Senator Rand Paul, you know, had a, you know, viral rant against the director of Homeland Security pushing this disinformation, this Orwellian censorship board. And so I think because of the pushback, they put it on pause. But, you know, there's other things. You know, there's financial controls. And I don't know if you remember the Canadian truckers were basically going to be cut off from their bank account.
Yeah, right.
For resisting and protesting the government.
And here's the other thing. I mean, this is relevant because well, just because it is. You're a member of a prominent family in this city and really in the world, a Crown family. And so you're a guy who's hailed, I assume, when you came in to co-purchase the Reader and salvage the newspaper. So rich guy hero, now rich guy bad guy. And they will use the fact that you're, you know, rich guy from a prominent family against you. Now you're some sort of sellout to the identitarian revolution the identitarian / COVIDian revolution or some such thing. And so is this why people of prominence and people with resources who you would think would be insulated in such a fashion that they could do what they want to do and the way they want to do it without fear. Is this why they're afraid of situations and experiences seeing that we see play out like yours?
Well, I can't really speak to that. You know, I do know that, you know, if you take anti-establishment views, especially if you're to the left of the Democratic Party, you're going to be attacked. I certainly have a lot of friends in that space, in investigative journalism who, you know, criticize the Democratic Party and take a lot of heat and personal attacks. So I was prepared for that, you know, when I wrote these columns. But I guess I wasn't prepared for the viciousness of the attacks. And yeah, you know, I guess it would make you think twice about doing it. I mean, I always felt that because I'm in this position, as you described, that I can take more risk because, you know, this isn't my livelihood. I am a criminal defense attorney. If I get fired from a journalist job or a report, you know, an op-ed job, and I've written op-eds for other papers too. You know, it's not going to ruin my career. I'm still going to be able to feed my kids. So, you know, I felt like I can take some risks. And so I am willing to do that and stick my neck out a little bit. But yeah, this has been quite an eye-opening experience.
What about other prominent people in the city in Chicago? Because I'm often critical of the prominent people that I think are generally insulated from reprisals, and they don't do enough. They sort of sit idly by while the city burns and while the Chicago Press Corps burns itself down, as a Chicago Reader has now joined that conflagration. Should people in your position, including you, hopefully, continue to be public and put in the fight for those things you say you believe?
I mean, I would hope everyone would, you know, stand up for their principles and, you know, fight for what they believe in. You know, I have to say, you know, my own family probably disagrees with my views on almost every topic. So, you know, it's not, I don't know that I can really put myself out there as, you know, a representative of, you know, influential families, because I'm not. You know, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I represent mostly poor people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not really my, I'm not the right person to ask that question to.
What do you think the future of the Reader is?
Well, I know they have some foundation support, and I hope it survives. And I guess we'll see. You know, for me, it's not as attractive of a paper as it was before, because, you know, it seems to be allowing only, you know, one point of view and not making space for people who disagree. And, you know, that's a shame, because there's so few places now where you can have a dissenting opinion. If you disagree about the war in Ukraine, that we ought to be flooding them with weapons, you know, there's no place for you in media. If you disagree about vaccine mandates or, you know, the lockdowns, there's really no place for you to get your message out there. So the Reader was always one of those places, which is why, as you correctly said, I stepped in back in, I think it was 2018, to help save the Reader.
Well, your viewpoints are always welcome here, Len, if nowhere else in Chicago.
You're in a safe space.
Yeah.
is the woke says.
Len Goodman, yeah. Chicago criminal defense attorney, adjunct professor at DePaul University College of Law, and founder of the Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting. Len Goodman, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. And bye-bye. He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I want to soothe the audience before this next segment.
Okay, Dan.
And also remember a great composer.
Oh, yeah.
Vangelis passed away yesterday.
Chariots of Fire.
Chariots of Fire.
Can we have great, a little Chariots of Fire, please?
The great Vangelis.
Thank you.
I feel like running on a beach and jumping up and down in the water right now. And I offer a tribute to Vangelis because he's a great composer, but also some soothing tunes because we're about to hear from the screamer. Howard Dean, yeah, he's still around. He was on MSNBC yesterday talking about the coverage of the Buffalo massacre over the weekend and prosecuting the case that you've heard Chuck Schumer, Pagliacci, and others prosecuting throughout the week, suggesting that the man who killed those people in Buffalo, murdered those people in Buffalo, was inspired by some version of a great replacement theory that is being pushed by conservatives, most notably their bete noire on television, Tucker Carlson. And this is what Howard Dean said to Ari Melber on MSNBC.
I see the brand of Fox being hate, anger, dishonesty, and now murder.
Murder.
Go on. If you want.
That's the brand. That's the brand that the Murdochs have chosen to fit, to be their flagship communication. And I agree with Biden. Murdoch has harmed this country more than any other human being in my lifetime, and he should never have been given citizen. The one thing I'd change about our immigration policy is to send Murdoch back to Australia and keep him there with the whole family.
It's funny you put it that way, and I don't have a position on individual level immigration, but you're free to.
If you cause that much trouble and you spread lies and hate and anger and tear the United States apart with your crappy TV show simply to make money, you do not belong. You do not deserve American citizenship, period.
It was important to hear that last bit of it, just in case you were going to dismiss Howard Dean as just engaging in your typical hyperbole. No, that's his actual position, is that Rupert Murdoch and his family should be deported and that Fox News is a purveyor of hate and apparently murder now.
Yeah. Second-degree murder, yeah.
I think he also went on to say that Brett Baer should have his undergraduate degree from DePaul University withdrawn by the university. I'm not sure. Brett Baer, host of Fox News Special Report, 5 p.m. Chicago time during the week, best-selling author of To Rescue the Republic, Ulysses S. Grant, The Fragile Union, and The Crisis of 1876. Brett, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning.
So the deportation of Rupert Murdoch and family is on the table over at MSNBC.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, actually.
You don't? You don't think?
I'm pretty sure that's not going to materialize. It's really amazing to see, you know, what gets stirred up and how, you know, some people react to certain things. You know, when it's, and we go through this prism all the time, when it's the flip side and there's a conversation about something controversial, it just doesn't seem like the other side goes after speech. And I think, you know, we as a country could do better in that regard to be able to deal with the problems at hand. And there are a lot of them across the country instead of, you know, what you just heard.
I think Dan Henninger had a good piece in the Journal the other day. We talked about it a bit yesterday, where he basically said, look, you have a mental illness problem in this country. He's talking about Buffalo in part. And when politicians don't know what to do about mental illness, which is a much more complicated problem, and it's something the country's been grappling with ever since the deinstitutionalization of mental patients, patients that have mental health issues in the 70s. Then it's easier to demagogue guns or demagogue race or play partisan politics ghoulishly over dead bodies which is what we see happen time and again when these atrocities occur.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think Dan has a point there. I think obviously all of these things are very emotional. It's a tragedy no matter what happened in Buffalo. But looking for the reason behind that shouldn't always go to speech and conversation and, as they say, stirring the pot. I think it's self-explanatory for most people out there, but maybe not. You know, maybe we need to do a better job of explaining what that does. Obviously, my job is to cover the news at 6 to 7 Eastern time, 5 to 6 your time, and we'll cover all sides of it, including those charges, which we did from Chuck Schumer and others.
It seems that this may be a bit of desperation on behalf of by Democrats as well, because what you've seen through primary season thus far is a significant increase in Republican turnout and an actual slight decrease compared to historic averages in Democrat turnout. Now, that has something to do with the how competitive some of these races are, of course. But it also does suggest that there's a real enthusiasm deficit that Democrats are trying to grapple with.
Listen, the issues do not favor Democrats. And there are a couple issues, obviously, that have popped up that that are going to change dynamics in some races. For example, the Roe v. Wade draft opinion that was leaked, and whatever the real opinion eventually is, that may change on the outskirts of some things. But the most important thing that people are really focused on is how they feel. Inflation affects everybody massively. And that's the biggest thing that you're going to look at, the U.S. economy and how people feel at the kitchen table by the time we get to early November.
Now, you had Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on, and he was dinging Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, calling him an isolationist for delaying the passage of that $40 billion Ukrainian aid package. Do you think there's going to be bad blood between them now?
Now?
I mean, going forward, yeah. I mean, are we going to get along?
There's been some bad blood over the years over a host of issues. Rand Paul is who he is, and he makes principled stance. But he's not alone on this front about $40 billion and being, you know, too much in this environment for the U.S. to be giving to Ukraine. McConnell made the case about why that's important in the big picture geopolitically to stop Russia from expanding to other places. But there are arguments to be had, Josh Hawley and others saying, when does it stop in this environment? That's what Congress is about, making those arguments. And the bottom line is whoever has the votes moves the bills along.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, 11 Republican senators voted against the $40 billion aid package. So, yeah, there is some pushback that's now afoot because the idea of this being open-ended, as well as, you know, just some of what's contained in the $40 billion, that's always another issue. But I wonder, too, since, you know, you're on the news side, the rumors that continue to disseminate about Putin's health, because obviously that would be a big factor in how this plays out in Eastern Europe, and that he had been treated for some sort of a blood cancer, that he's surrounded by doctors. You know, is that a story that you're following, and have you been able to flesh it out anything that you're comfortable saying this is what we know to be true at this point?
No, I don't think it's to that point, like solidified, but we do have intel sources who are looking at intelligence that the U.S. is gathering and the EU is gathering, who do say that he's being treated for some sort of blood cancer and that he has changed in health in recent months. What that means, the extent of it, is there a succession plan? We don't have that nailed down as of yet.
So if he goes, we don't know who's going to step in, and we don't know what their policies will be.
The people closest to him, it's not that wonderful. I mean, they're
right,
kind of in the same vein, but they would have a lot less power than he would, and that would raise questions about the other circle around that person.
Just going back to the leaked Dobbs opinion and the fallout from that, the protests, an interesting moment this week when Attorney General Merrick Garland essentially said, look, those protests outside the homes of Supreme Court justices are inappropriate and we're going to enforce the law, something that newly minted Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson couldn't bring herself to say. And it seemed to be a moment where he broke from the administration and the administration's base supporters.
I agree with you. And I think that the messaging from the White House has been different than the messaging from the DOJ. And they're seeing real-time threats. DHS puts out this internal memo about the threats around when the real ruling comes down, to the point where they're talking about efforts to storm the Supreme Court or take out justices. And I think there is a real dichotomy in how both sides are talking about it. When I say both sides, justice and DHS and the White House, they're talking about protecting protesters' rights and how it has to be peaceful. But the threats that they've listed are not peaceful.
All right, before we let you go, who do you think wins the PGA this weekend?
I tell you what, I like Rory. Rory looks good. He's got you hit a 369-yard drive, you're in a good position.
Yeah.
In the middle of the fairway.
Good ball striking. Yeah, good ball striking. Brett Baer, Fox News, host of Special Report, 5 p.m. weekday Chicago time. Also the best-selling author of To Rescue the Republic, Ulysses S. Grant, The Fragile Union, and The Crisis of 1876. Brett, thanks as always.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. An AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Technically, the summer of joy does not begin until the first day of summer, June 21st, so you can't count last night's mass shooting at State in Chicago against Mayor Triple Threat. 10 shot. Two dead, one in custody.
And gun recovered right outside, right by Holy Name Cathedral at the McDonald's there.
And here's what one witness to the shooting, here's what she said.
We walked across the street to the store, and next thing you know, they people start shooting, and everybody just got hit. My first instinct was just run, because I've been hit before. So it's like, coming down here doing all this nonsense is not necessary at all, because look what just happened. Now all of y'all hit, hurt in the hospital, when all y'all want to do is enjoy yourself.
And the saddest part is that this happened to her before, so she knew what to do.
Well, that she's been hit before. She's been shot.
Right.
How many people walking around the city who've been shot?
Well, it's probably a lot more than we think.
And they're desensitized to the violence, just like so many people desensitized to the violence when you just look at the headlines, the weekend body count and so forth. And yesterday after the shooting, too, when police did arrive on the scene, I mean, it was pandemonium. You had fights breaking out. You had people running all over the place as police tried to resume order. And, of course, this is on the back of last weekend's violence, including the 16-year-old that was shot and killed at Millennium Park, leading to the curfews at Millennium Park, which began last night and will be taken up by the city council today.
It's not only a curfew, too. It's they're winding you down now. They also can check your IDs. You have to have an ID, some sort of ID, whether it be a student ID, military ID, driver's license. They can ask you for that at any point in time, these private security company that the mayor has.
That sounds racist.
That's what I said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez, who's also a candidate for mayor. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Dan and Amy, good morning.
Appreciate it. So where do you come down on this Millennium Park curfew? And if it's good for Millennium Park, should it be instituted citywide?
Well, I think that the mayor's effort is just one of her latest attempts to make it look as though she's actually doing something. But what she has, in fact, done is created a curfew chaos, if you will, with how are we going to enforce it, who is going to enforce it, and starting with what's going on yesterday and this weekend, is it even legal for her by executive order to do this? Now, she is asking the city council to edit the current curfew laws, making it 10 p.m. for young people 12 to 17 and 8:30 for those 11 and under. But we are already stretched thin, dangerously thin within our police department, locally in our districts. And if we're going to pull out more officers from our districts just to enforce a curfew on Millennium Park only, that's going to endanger thousands of lives throughout many of the communities that are dealing with gun violence on a daily basis. You know, we talk about the mass shooting that was yesterday, but Tuesday there was a mass shooting in Back of the Yard,
yeah,
where we saw the video of that people on the corner being shot with that young boy running for his life, God, just trying to get home from school. And it takes us time to respond to these when our beat integrity is compromised by 50%. And it's going to take us even longer to respond if she's pulling out more officers from local districts to enforce this curfew.
Yeah, there were three-hour wait times for 911 calls on Saturday because of the craziness at, yes, Millennium Park. They all had to, you know, all the resources had to go there, and people waited that long. So that's not a sustainable system, don't you think?
It is 100% unsustainable because you're going to steal from Peter to pay for Paul, and at the end you're not going to impact and improve public safety in a way that is going to be continued throughout the entire summer in the city of Chicago.
Well,
Dan, you said it correctly. It doesn't even start until June, and we're already at 4 mass shootings in the city of Chicago this month alone.
Well, if the resources are stretched thin, in part because, as we poured over the numbers earlier in the week, you've had a net loss of about 2,000 cops in the last 3 years, then why isn't the city council beating the drum for more police to be hired in addition to supporting neighborhoods, frankly, that are hiring private security just to have more eyes and ears on the streets and provide a little bit more of a disincentive for criminal activity? That was something she was very concerned about, the mayor, when Bucktown residents were doing it. It's something now she's actually doing herself in Millennium Park.
You know, city council has made the positions available, but the failure has been on Lori Lightfoot to fill the positions. And she has created an environment where no one wants to work for her in the Chicago Police Department. That is solely an abdication of her leadership in trying to make it welcoming for individuals who want to be a part of the force, who want to help serve and protect the city of Chicago. Now, until that changes in 10 months, we have to look at the other tools that we have available to assist our dwindling forces. Because, yes, we are down about 2,000 individuals. Last year, I think we replaced 900 with only 51 new recruits. So we need to look at other options to help law enforcement do its job correctly, such as investing in more technology, putting, for example, license plate readers in a broader, expansive network throughout the city of Chicago so that we could find those stolen cars that are driving around causing mayhem in our streets in real time. And we have the funds to do it. You know, we just gave the University of Chicago $31 million so that they could have on-campus cameras funded by taxpayers to protect their university. Why can't we spend $300 million to protect the city of Chicago as a whole? But we're not looking at those kind of things. And I think city council absolutely needs to reconvene in a special meeting to bring Brown and the mayor into the room and have this conversation once again. We did it last year for the 4th of July weekend after we saw weeks of chaos in our city. We're heading towards Memorial Day weekend now with 4 mass shootings under our belt already. And I think the city council must bring them in. People, they must hear from us directly, and we must hold them to task for what they do or fail to do for the people of the city of Chicago.
Now, on Monday, you're going to be voting on the casino. There's going to be some special meeting on the Bally's Casino, and how do you stand on that?
Well, we don't know if we're going to be even voting on that Monday. We were scheduled to look at possibly approving that out of committee today, but that got bumped to legalize the mayor's curfew order and public safety today. So all of this chaos and pandemonium is happening and putting things off further and further down the line because the mayor just does not have a comprehensive strategy for leading the city of Chicago. Now, if Bally's does, in fact, come to the agenda on Monday, if there's another meeting before Monday, you know, I have some serious reservations about that. We already have issues with crime and safety. You know, we know this was a a cooked deal from the start by this administration. It wasn't a fair and open process like they say it was. And that should make everyone nervous, because we don't need any more backroom deals by anyone in City Hall. And for someone who said they were going to bring in the light, and they brought in, you know, their own special interests and deals to make Chicago better, that gives me pause.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What? Uh-oh.
Oh, no. Now you've done it.
You gone done what?
With the casino, I mean, the reason that Bailey's got wired up, and it was smart on Bailey's part, is they got labor on their side. And that's why that deal was a done deal from the beginning. So, Alderman Lopez, if you start to make noise about a casino, much less vote against it, you are going to draw the ire of organized labor in Chicago. Do you really want to do that?
Well, Dan, let me just clarify something. They're all going to be built with organized labor. This notion that it was only Bally's that was working with the unions is preposterous, and it's a false headline that's being thrown out there just to force the issue and force support for Bally's. It would be required to have a labor agreement in this state. It's required by state law to make sure that is there. So all of that was going to be in the works no matter what. And I've said this to numerous labor people who have been supportive and reaching out to me on this issue, is that regardless who was picked, unions were going to be involved. Unions will be working, and unions will be a part of the workforce. That's guaranteed in this city.
And when, yeah, but I know, but this is the one they want. And what, and when you say that to them,
well, this
what
is
do
the
they
one
Lori
wants.
Well, what do they say
well,
to
this
you?
Is
what
the one Lori wants.
What does the CFL say to you when you say that?
Well, they haven't contacted me, but I'll tell you that other labor groups have said, "Well, we know that, but this is the one that we're getting behind,
right?
Because this is the one the mayor has picked."
Right.
Well, she can pick it. But at the end of the day, if it's not a good deal for the city of Chicago, that's who I have to work and look out for. Mm-hmm. This isn't anti-labor. Labor will always be a part of this. So there's no loss for them. It's just a matter of where it goes and where it will have the most impact. If you put a $2 billion casino on a two-lane road like Halsted Street, you're going to create chaos. If you put a temporary location across from a residential community, you're going to have chaos. And let's think about something else. This $2 billion investment has been rushed through in 3 weeks in a secretive process. Look, by comparison, the Lincoln Yards $2 billion residential development project, which took 8.5 months of public discussion, along with nearly 3 years of other discussions locally by Alderman Hopkins and others to make sure that the process was fair, open, and all concerns addressed. There's a right way and a wrong way to do this, and right now we're doing it the wrong way.
I know this has sort of gotten swept under the excitement of the casino and so forth, but you know, Boeing is moving out, and they're going to the East Coast, and there's continuing concern about the future of big players in the city, the exchanges, Citadel, other corporate footprints not in the West Loop. What is your perspective on how precarious the city's business community, how precarious it is that the vibrant business community that still exists to some extent in Chicago is in jeopardy?
The climate in Chicago is that from the business leaders and many of the major economic engines that make up the great city of Chicago, they are all hanging on by a thread right now. If we have another summer, as we're coming up on the anniversary of George Floyd's murder, where we have madness and mayhem again, if we have the continued slow water drip of mass shootings and gun violence on a daily basis continue to make the headlines every single day, more and more businesses and investment groups and things of that nature are going to leave this city, because the perception is that we are out of control. We are adrift in this country, and the criminals are running the show. We have to put an end to that. We have to change the narrative. We have to take control of the reins of this city and show that we can bring back safety and build an economy that is welcoming and vibrant, not just for the businesses that are here now, but for those that we want to attract, for the tourism that we need, for the convention space that we need to have to help bring people to this city. All of that is hanging on a thread, and if we continue down this road, we are not going to like the city of Chicago that we see 5 years from now. We will be a very different city if we do not make the necessary corrections in the next year to not only change our image, but to make sustainable, lasting improvements to public safety and to our economy that works for everyone, provides opportunities for everyone, and ends this culture of enablement and entitlement that we see that is having such a negative impact on our society here in the city of Chicago.
Now, I got to ask you about this. You're certainly going to be peppered about it during the course of the campaign. There's a story out a couple of weeks ago that this home that you have on 64th and Kedzie, you bought in 2007, you haven't made a mortgage payment in a decade, according to a lawsuit that was filed against you by the mortgage company. What's the deal with that?
My mortgage is paid. My taxes are paid. This is a loan that we're working with the bank to resolve. It should have been done months ago. We're just waiting for the paperwork for the bank. You know, there's a lot of individuals trying to twist the story to say that I don't pay my bills, but I don't know anyone that could not pay a mortgage for 10 years and still own their home.
Well, I know. That's why it's such an odd story. But
Is it a lie? Is it true?
You're current, or you're getting current, or what's the story?
We're getting current, and we'll be current within the next few weeks as soon as the bank finalizes the paperwork.
Okay. All right. He is 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez, also a candidate for mayor in 2023. That's a February 2023 primary right around the corner. Alderman Lopez, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Amy and Dan, thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Two sports I don't care anything about. One isn't even a sport, soccer. But nonetheless, skateboarding and soccer, which would you like to tackle first?
Oh, Amy? I've got a fingerboarder on my team. Do you know what a fingerboarder is? He's a thrasher, he's a skateboarder, but then he also has got a little mini. It's this new thing that he's got a little mini skateboard, and it's called fingerboarding. And one of his friends that fingerboards with him, he's a big YouTuber, and he's making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they put up little obstacles. You can buy little, you know, handwood gadgets to make it look like a mini skate park. And that's what they do, and they record it and make money.
Sounds like a complete waste of time. skateboarder Taylor Silverman, she's a female skateboarder who, you know, competes in these skateboarding contests.
Yeah.
And we have a resident expert on skateboarding, Justin, our technical producer, who drives a skateboard to work every day, so he can weigh in on this if he'd like as well.
Yeah.
She is speaking out after placing second in a recent skateboarding contest event.
No, this is a big deal, Dan.
I don't know what they call it.
They're competition, skateboard competition.
Because skateboarders got a competition. Yes. She finished second, and this was sponsored by Red Bull. That makes sense. Here's what she said: I'm a female athlete. I've been skateboarding for 11 years and competing for several years. I've been in three different contests with trans women, two of which I placed second. At the last contest series I did for Red Bull, I placed second. The trans competitor who won took $1,000 in qualifiers, $3,000 in finals, and $1,000 in best trick. That totaled $5,000 of the prize money meant for female athletes. I took $1,000 in qualifiers, $1,750 for second place, and $2,750 in total. The girl who took third received $750. The girl who deserved $1,000 for best trick took nothing along with whoever would have placed third. I deserve to place first, be acknowledged for my win, and get paid. I reached out to Red Bull and was ignored. I'm sick of being bullied into silence. Taylor Silverman doesn't believe she should be competing against men in skateboarding. This is how far
it's gone.
This trans ideology, this is how rapacious it is. It's all over sport to the point of even skateboarding.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And, of course, she's being pilloried online by the Blue Check Mafia and the aspirants to join the Blue Check Mafia as Nothing more than a sore loser. Is that what she is, sore loser? Is that a is
no? She wants
know.
A competitive playing field.
Well, is that is there a difference in male and female agility, strength? You know, at the professional skateboarding level, where men would have an advantage.
You know, I haven't.
She believes so, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, men and women are made differently. Mm-hmm. Different testosterone levels could play a part because you need stamina and strength and agility to skateboard.
You know, it's interesting you bring up testosterone, and no, this isn't going to be a low T spot, but there is a new paper out by a graduate student at Claremont University, that is. Testosterone administration induces a red shift in Democrats. We tested the fixity of political preferences of 136 healthy males during the 2011 presidential election season by administering synthetic testosterone or placebo to participants who had identified the strength of their political affiliation. Before the testosterone treatment, we found weakly affiliated Democrats had 90% higher basal testosterone than those who identified strongly with the party. When weakly affiliated Democrats received additional testosterone, the strength of their party fell by 12%, and they reported 45% warmer feelings toward Republican candidates for president. So the bottom line is infusing men wearing pea hats who are voting for Democrat socialists with testosterone turns them into real men.
Ew.
Is that interesting? I mean, it's just science.
No, it's just,
I'm a man of science. It's just the science and the data. Oh, that's all. I'm just relaying the science and the data. But anyway, back to our friend Taylor Silverman there and her complaint about skateboarding against boys. You know, I note in the competitions and the, you know, the version of is skateboarding in the Summer Olympics now, or is it demonstration sport or anything like snowboarding?
Snowboarding.
It's an event.
Yeah, that's an event for sure.
Well, I know, see. But so
no,
something that, like that.
No, it was a competition this year. Yes.
So I note that that is still male and female at the Olympic level.
Right.
But now, of course, so that was how it was conceived. That's how it's operating, kind of, sort of. Now, again, the IOC is going the way of Western culture and, you know, has these rules, as we saw in the last Olympics, that are allowing men to compete in women's sports, too. But I just am starting from the baseline here that as it was originally conceived until 5 minutes ago, it was male versus male and female versus female, even in sports like snowboarding or like skateboarding.
Yeah. At the Summer Olympics 2020, they had men's park finals and women's skateboarding park finals.
So. Elliot and Wilmette.
Hello. I'm not into the sport, but from what I understand, college tennis players receive a rating so that they can measure themselves against all other college tennis players. And any male-rated player should be able to beat any woman player, and even the Wimbledon women's champion. And if for that matter, why don't they get rid of men's and women's Wimbledon distinction?
Well, absolutely, it's just a sport. There's no gender divide. That's exactly where this should go logically. It's not going there though. Interestingly, so a related story. Now, this is men and women, as far as I know. The U.S. Soccer Federation announcing this week it's agreed to pay players on the women's national team, like Megan Rapinoe, the same as it pays players on the men's national team. The collective bargaining contract will run through 2028, includes the equalization of World Cup prize money, that is. Yeah. More details on this. The agreement will afford women's players, in addition to equal pay prospectively, $22 million in back pay. Identical economic terms. Equalization of FIFA World Cup prize money, identical appearance fees and game bonuses, commercial revenue sharing for the first time. Is that a wonderful breakthrough for the women's soccer team and for women athletes everywhere?
I think it's fine they're getting equal pay for the finals if they make it that far. Good for them.
Really? So it doesn't matter that, for instance, the Women's World Cup reached a high of 1.12 billion viewers across the world. Okay. The Men's World Cup, 3.572 billion viewers worldwide, and earned $6 billion in profits.
But the female, the Women's World Cup soccer team is much more successful than the men's. Do you know any male players on the Men's Cup? Because, no, you know Megan Rapinoe.
I know Megan Rapinoe because she made a political spectacle of herself.
Yes.
Not because I'm following this calisthenic that people call soccer. The 2010 Men's World Cup team earned $4 billion in revenue. The Women's World Cup, the World Cup itself, the actual contest, I should say, not the team.
Not the team.
The American team. The overall $4 billion in revenue. The Women's World Cup earned $73 million in revenue. So, you know, 40x plus more revenue generated by the men's competition than the women's. But you think it's great that they should be paid the same? So you should be paid.
This is just in postseason play. Like, this is not, you know, for the regular season. This is just what's going to be, you know, broadcast throughout the country and probably throughout the world because there's so many soccer fans out there.
Yeah. All right. So let's see if we can walk through this. 3.5 billion viewers to 1.12 billion viewers. Which will generate more advertising revenue?
Well, you're talking about women. They can sell a lot of products post the game. Yeah, obviously.
Do you know how advertising revenue works? It's based on viewership. You understand this?
I understand. Yes, you don't have to be. I understand.
Well, so then, defend
your
position.
The women, if they make it to postseason play, good for them. They should make the same amount of money as the
men
in the game,
regardless of the money they generate. Why?
Because of equality. Because they earned it. And people watch women's soccer because they're hot chicks playing soccer. Some of them are.
Uh-huh. If people watch
what are the ratings?
Women
you know
playing
the ratings
soccer
are?
At, well, I just gave you an example on the World Cup. So they watch it at one-third the rate they watch men's soccer, but you say they should be paid the same regardless of the interest and the associated revenue that's generated.
I know.
So that's how people should be paid based on their gender, not based on
what they're successful.
What they generate. What does
in
that mean?
Because they made it to the playoffs.
So the women's the two teams that play in the WNBA finals, all those players should receive the same as the two teams, the men on the two teams that reach the NBA finals, right?
Oh, basketball is different. I mean,
how is it different?
Nobody, I think more people watch women's soccer than they watch the WNBA. Sorry, Mike Scott, but
I'm sorry, you're conflating all sorts of things because there's not a logical thread to your argument. I understand why you need to do that.
Yeah,
but
that's not true at all.
Not true at all?
What Amy is saying, the amount of fan participation for women's professional soccer, for example, in England, which has the Women's Super League. They can barely draw 1,000 people to their games, to their best games.
I don't even know that league that you're talking about.
It's the best women's professional league in the world.
Okay. Right.
And the men will draw 67 to 70,000 at a regular, no-nonsense English professional league game.
Yeah, I mean, the Manchester United is like the fifth most expensive franchise in the sports world, in the world.
I guess I'm just pointing out that comparison is a bit of a fallacy.
Yeah, well, but also we're not comparing women's soccer to the WNBA. We're comparing women's soccer to men's soccer when it comes to payment, and women's basketball to men's basketball when it comes to payment.
Right.
And so if women's soccer players should make the same as men soccer players, despite the massive disparities in interest and revenue in favor of the men, then why shouldn't the WNBA players be paid the same as the male NBA players, despite the massive difference in interest and revenue generation there?
Yeah, that argument holds. However, the talent level, for example, in women's soccer is extremely high. The talent level in the WNBA is extremely high. So the bonus question is, why can't we get people to come out for those events?
Well, I mean, the talent is extremely high, except then we also have to pay a 15-year-old boys team from Dallas the same as the women's World Cup team because they beat them.
You're right. Yeah, that happened. It was about 4 years ago.
So maybe that's why there's not the same interest level, because it's just not the same game when women are playing it versus men. I mean, if we're being honest, with the speed and the interest and the power and so on, for the things that people like to see. Like, you know, they like to see LeBron James dunk. They like to see Antetokounmpo go coast to coast, and in a way that you're not going to see athletes that are in a class by themselves in the women's game. You're just not. Maybe in context of women, but okay, whatever. If everybody liked it, if the roles were reversed, put it this way, if 3 billion people were watching the women's World Cup team and World Cup, and 1 billion were watching the men's World Cup, would people be saying, oh, it's completely fair that men are being paid the same?
Right. I think that that's true. The thing about the women's team is that they have seen sustained success since early 1990, whereas the men have had ultimately, massive failures on the international level.
It doesn't matter. What does success have to do with this? We're talking about money. What does success have to do with the revenue? So you could, I mean, if nobody wants to go see the White Sox, even if they win a World Series, and everybody wants to go see the Cubs, and they generate more revenue than the White Sox did, so the Cubs should only get to spend as much as the White Sox spend or less because the White Sox were more successful than the Cubs? What's success?
I think the point that I'm trying to make is that how the international game is valued is a little different in soccer, for example, than basketball or almost any other sport. What you do internationally determines your value, not necessarily what you do domestically.
Determines your market value?
Yes. That's how much you, for example, how much you get paid on the professional level. The international game is so different than the American game.
Well, I understand, but on straight dollars and cents, these are businesses. These are private sector businesses.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're right.
Yeah, so how do you can't justify the same salary based on the revenue generation? There's just no justification for it. So they're doing this by fiat, not based on economics. And they're doing it only because it's identitarian politics, because it's women.
Yes.
Again, if it was reversed with it, would there be any problem with doing that turn for the men that we're doing for the women? Of course there would be. They'd be saying it's unfair. Women are generating all this and the men, nobody's interested in the men. How dare they expect to be the same as women? And then it's just like equality, you know, these just throw out these buzzwords that can't be explained.
Yeah, the arm twisting to get this done over the last 3.5 years almost makes it feel like a false victory.
Well, of course, because you know, the people, because somebody's got to pay the bill.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, it's just this is total sentimentality, as nicely laid out by Amy. Don and McHenry, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, it's Don in Grapevine, Texas again. And, yeah, Dan, I'm just kind of astounded at how people are falling, Amy, and are falling in this trap, because it has nothing to do with male, female. And I would just simply say, just to illustrate that, if tomorrow you just said, okay, you got to pay the WNBA players as much as the NBA players, that would be the end of the WNBA.
Of course it would.
There's no money. If you don't have the money, you can't do it. It's just a ridiculous argument because you said it best. It has nothing to do with male, female. It has to do with what's the business generating. If you don't generate the income, you can't pay the employees that much.
I mean, this is so – I know. It seems so basic, but it's not basic when gender's at bar. Then it's like, I feel that somebody should be paid something. Oh, good. You know, I feel I should be paid as much as Rush Limbaugh was making. Well, I feel that way.
It's a good argument. Well, that's a good argument. Now, I can make an argument for you, Dan, that you might deserve
that. Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Money,
yeah, but, well, you know, yeah, thank you. But
we pat each other on the back.
But Rush Limbaugh generated the salary he generated because of the audience size he had.
Sure, he put an entire frequency on his back.
Yeah, or flips. I should be paid as I don't know. Think of a Dr. Laura. I should be paid the same as Dr. Laura. We're both radio talk show hosts. I should be paid the same as Dr. Laura. She's got a much bigger audience than we have on Morning Answer. But I feel that way.
Yeah.
You feel any way you want. Yep.
I know I can feel any way I want. The problem is when it's translated into the distribution of scarce resources. That's the issue, not my feelings or your feelings. Mike in Lombard.
Yeah, I was just since the 80s, Women's Lib has been pushing women into men's sports. When I was in high school, they were trying to do that. And now we have trans men competing in women's sports. Women kind of brought this on themselves. They wanted to be equal, and now it's not. Now, I mean, are you equal or you aren't? This argument goes back and forth, and now we're in, so they should get pay when they don't earn the same viewership. And it just seems kind of ridiculous to me. And then they want to complain. There's always all these special groups, and everybody wants to complain whenever it doesn't. It's convenient for them. It's just starting to drive me crazy.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, I'm special. I'm special. This is what I deserve to be paid.
They advocated for themselves, and they won. I mean,
they did do that, but only because of the political ground they were able to stand on right now.
Of course.
Yeah. They wouldn't have moved forward with this if they didn't think they could win.
That's like saying, oh, you know, the teachers union advocated for themselves and they won. Oh, so you support them?
Thugs.
Anybody who, well, oh, they're thugs. Why? Why they use
because
political?
Because they use children as political
whatever.
Pawns.
They use political clout to get the money they
they're
want.
Professional athletes.
And they use
political
sports.
Clout
yes.
yep. to get what they want. The same way the women's soccer team is. You sell it did. And the managerial class in U.S. soccer capitulates, just like the mayor's office capitulates. But you like it when political clout's used for something you like, and you don't like it when it's used for something you don't like. Nothing consistent about that.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
It's that time of the week, Open Mic Friday, taking your calls with comments, compliments, criticisms, general crack pottery, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. I don't even know why I'm getting so exercised about USA Soccer. If they're going to pay women and men the same amount, regardless of the underlying economics, this is nothing but good news for me.
Why?
Because the U.S. soccer team will go away. They'll go bankrupt. Less soccer.
Maybe they'll attract more fans to the games. Who knows? I mean, the U.S. women's soccer team is so much better than the men's. The men's is like non-existent.
Yeah, so much better against women.
Right.
Yeah, against women. Or, you know, if they have to play 15-year-old boys from...
They have back-to-back World Cup championships.
Yeah, if they have to play 15-year-old boys in Dallas, it's not so good. Drew in the Western Burbs.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Hey, Dan, I'm really excited that you're excited about soccer as someone who's played the game my whole life and has coached as well. So it's probably about 40 years involvement with the sport. So saying all that, I can definitely concur that this is a bad move, if you will. I think this is yet another reason that soccer will not gain mass support in this country. This is, again, the sport, unfortunately, that introduced Let's Give Awards to Everyone Who Participates.
Oh,
but
that's right.
At the end of the day, MLS soccer is more popular than the women's pro game. Now, while the men's team has done awful internationally and will continue to do so, and while the women's team has been more successful, Dan, as you pointed out, and correctly so, the economics are people are still seeing a less better team in the men's team play than a women's team that's more successful. For whatever reason, men's soccer is still what people watch much more. So to make parity, I think, is just a bad move.
Is Karl-Heinz Grenitzer still playing? I think that's the last soccer player.
No, he's not. I think he's working with Heinz 56.
Oh, my God, you guys.
So. All right, thanks, Drew. Appreciate it. Yeah. Right. Amy, did you have a rebuttal for that?
No, I'm good. All right. And I was going to get something off my chest, but I'm going to wait because I'm exhausted from everything. So I'm going to wait until next week, if that's okay with you, if I can call in to open mic, Mike.
Sure. Yeah.
On Friday.
Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Oh, good morning, guys. My cardiologist told me that I have to take the stress out of my day. Mm-hmm. So my new plan, I know, well, just for, you know, I don't know. My plan now is to play golf and pickleball every day as much as I can. I want to invite you, Dan and or Amy, to come out and play pickleball with us. We're trying to rally the conservatives out of the woodwork out here to play in a, you know, just get together and hang out down at the pickleball court and just
can
inspire,
I, can I,
get these guys.
Can I play against women?
Sure. Yeah. Will I get, play against me. If I could play against you, I would be in heaven. It would
Will I get paid the same if I play against women?
There's no pay. Sure. I'll pay you. Come on out. And then Amy, we'll get out. We're going to make Dan, you know, hold up on his promise that we're going to be Gus out at Olympia. It looks like we can't do it till September or something, I think we said. So Dan,
we've got pickleball courts there now, too, I think, that are coming in.
Yeah. Oh, let's play there. Why come out to the burbs? Why come out here?
Sure.
You know, it kind of sucks out here.
Yeah, sure. All right.
Yeah, all right. Looking forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. We'll look forward to that pickleball contest. Ryan, New Lenox.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. This whole soccer equal pay thing, I work in professional services, and, you know, I'm not a partner. Amy's argument is like equivalent to me walking into a partner's office who makes, you know, a lot of money, because they bring in a lot of money to the firm and they're, you know, compensated thusly. It would be like if I walked into the partner that I work with at his office and said, I deserve to be paid just as much as you do, even though I bring in way less money to the business than you. Right?
That's pretty much how I see it, Ryan. Yeah. And how do you think that would go for you?
I would definitely not get as much as they, and I would, probably end up on an employee counseling plan.
Yes, right.
Be on the swift road out the door. So I just don't understand why, I mean, Amy, respectfully, you're not seeing kind of...
This is just for postseason play. This is not for the entire season equal pay.
But that's
irrelevant.
So if they
worked hard and they're talented and they got there and the men's team
Everybody works hard.
No, they don't. I'm a coach. No, they don't. Absolutely not. No, that is bull jive statement. People do. Inherently, some people are more motivated than others. Inherently, some people are more aggressive than others. And teams, cohesive team, they're going to succeed.
So you should be paid.
Rewarded because you made it to the playoffs.
You get rewarded based on your effort. You get rewarded based on the inputs, not based on the outputs. The economics don't matter. Yeah, that's the position. The economics don't matter. The economics of the business don't matter. Okay, well, that's one way to run a business for a short period of time.
And then if they don't succeed, you're right, Dan, then they will bite themselves in the foot when they have to fold.
Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Okay, I get cut off, but the funny cutoffs are by Uber drivers. When you cut me off, please don't have that stupid plane in the back of your window that I know you're an Uber driver, because you're supposed to be the best drivers on the street. But you have your stupid plane and your insignia that says I'm a dumb Uber driver that I don't know how to drive. So have it off if you're going to cut me off, please. Right. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing and stupid because you don't know how to drive.
Thanks for the call, Vince. We're lucky we were able to defuse a potential road rage situation.
Mike Scott liked that one. Yeah.
Oh. Uber drivers, not necessarily the best drivers on the road.
No.
Yeah, this just in.
And truck drivers are getting really bad, and I think it's because they're allowing 18-year-olds to be truck drivers.
Bob in Naperville.
Yeah, Amy, with all due respect, like the other caller, you're just flat out wrong. You know, we keep on marching further away from, you know, market capitalism. You know, you get paid what you do, you know, the whole equality thing as well, you know, the NBA, where's the percentage of white people? It's like the argument falls flat when it comes to, you know, not having equality on the basketball court. And for your alma mater, Amy, watching the Iowa hoops team playing the NCAA tournament this year, here's five white guys on the court at the same time, and they're all wearing equality on the back of their jersey. You know, it's just crazy where we're going.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, Amy, you're just wrong. It's just wrong. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks,
right,
Bob, for
thanks,
calling.
Bob.
I don't mind being told that you think I'm wrong.
Rick, Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I, this is not what I called in, but I'll make a comment about your soccer thing.
Yeah.
I would rather watch somebody make their bed for 3 hours than watch 30 seconds of soccer. But what I call in about, you know how people and companies say they're woke? And I'm like Tucker Carlson, I don't understand. I'm confused. Because I know if you're woke, that means you're intolerant and that you believe in CRT, which is racism. So you're basically saying, I'm an intolerant racist, but there's got to be more to being woke than just saying to everybody, hey, I'm an intolerant racist. I mean, can you explain it or better yet define what being woke really is?
Well, I mean, what it is from the perspective of the woke or what it is in actuality, because what it is in actuality is what you just described. What it is from their perspective is, you know, they're compassionate, empathetic individual. They're interested in justice and equality and even more equity. And so they just feel their way through life. It's not this is not mutually exclusive. You don't have to think or feel. You're supposed to think and feel, but they remove the thinking part, and that becomes a problem.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, basically, you're an intolerant racist. So I think that pretty much sums her up.
Thanks, Rick. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I'm going to get a bit sidetracked on the soccer as well. I'm just wondering if, Dan, I haven't watched any men's or women's soccer. I wonder if they're as good as men are at reacting like they just got hit by an IED when someone bumps into them.
The flops and, rival.
Moreover, Dan,
rival
I wanted to say it was a great interview you and Amy had with the writer who is being canceled by the left. And it ought to serve as a cautionary tale to everyone on the right that they'll come for you and they don't care who you are. So you guys have a good weekend.
Thanks, Tom. Well, it should serve as a cautionary tale for so many people on the left, at least people like Len Goodman, who are maybe we may disagree with on some issues. We certainly do, but is at least sort of thoughtful and puts together actual arguments and tries to think through things like he did in the column where he's debating whether or not to have a 6-year-old daughter vaccinated. Conservatives should be on notice long ago. It's people like Len Goodman who should be on notice, given what happened to Len Goodman. Oh, no. And again, remember, this is a member of the Crown family.
Right.
This is
he's a guy who, no, when you said that, you brought
50%
that up.
Ownership in the Chicago Reader. And he gets run out of there on a rail by the mob.
Just because of his positions on vaccine. And it's a private family issue, too, for him.
Susan in Highland Park.
Hi there. I'm jumping in at the end of the game, no pun intended, listening to the discussion of soccer play pay. And if the females can negotiate a salary that's as equivalent to the more successful male team members, then great for them.
They have better
negotiated themselves, better agents. And isn't that what it's all about? Everyone takes a risk. If they don't perform, maybe it'll show back at the next time their contract is due.
Yeah, but
this is going to last until 2028.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Susan. Yeah, but nobody's saying there should be a law against them being paid equally. They're saying, is this sensible? And what is this reflective of culturally? Good intentions connected to sound economics, you know, per the Acton Institute. That's what we're in the business of when we talk about what makes sense in this world, whether it is public policy or whether it's just cultural touchstones. So nobody's saying the law should step in and write the salaries. No, this is a private organization. They can pay people whatever they want. Does it make sense? And as I said, you can go ahead and celebrate people using political clout and people who are poltroons like the management at U.S. Soccer. But then don't come to me and express your outrage when different people use political clout to achieve ends that you don't like or that you don't think improve the culture and our understanding of things like connecting sound economics to good intentions. That's the point. And don't invoke equality as if this is some blow for blow in the favor of equality. It isn't. What it is equity, which is the antithesis of equality. So let's understand our terminology and let's understand what's happening here and the precedents that these sorts of incidents set. And the misunderstandings of things like sound economics and real equality. Kathy, Southwest Side.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. Just to end, I do agree with what you guys are saying. My daughter had a lemonade stand, and the people across the street did, and she made three times the money. Why should they have to, you know, get the same amount and split it all equally? It doesn't make any sense, so I don't agree that they should. They're not making the same amount of money in revenue, then they shouldn't get paid the same. But on a different note, I wanted to just go back and comment on the alderman that you had on earlier. You know, he is really clueless when it comes to saying that we've got a slow grip of crime and we need to change the rhetoric. No, it is, you're bursting at the seams, and people do not want to, they're avoiding the city like the plague. It is a crime out of control, and no one wants to get shot on the way home from the Sox game. It's insanity.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. There was just another report this week, 500 expressway shootings in the last 3 years, most in the country. So to your point about on the way home from Sox game, of course, you had that that woman, the former teacher from Oak Lawn, who was killed on the Dan Ryan coming home from a Sox game last year. Wasn't that last year?
Yeah.
No.
Went through the taillight and killed her.
It's Mad Max stuff.
And then they let them go because it was mutual combatants, remember?
So it's the combination of what's actually happening, you know, downtown, and then what's happening on the expressways coming to or from downtown. Underreported aspect of it. Mike Melrose.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, nobody has mentioned this yet, but if Megan Rapinoe wants to make as much as the men make, why doesn't she play on the men's team where that's the going rate?
Because she's not good enough.
Oh, wait, she's not good enough.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Terry Rogers Park.
Hey, I think maybe Democrat politicians are exercising so much authority over citizens these days is they've become envious of the power their European allies have over their people. I think the Dems are after that same kind of power.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Bob Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan and Amy. In the 7 o'clock hour, you broached the subject of mental illness. I'm going to get a little down right now, but let me offer this sad, sad anniversary. It was 34 years ago today that Lori Dan went into the Winnetka School and killing one child and injuring several other children. Today, we still have the repeated shootings continue, and some of them with individuals who have serious mental illnesses. I'm just wondering if we can get a solution to this, diagnose these troubled individuals. And one more thing, what did you guys do? I was watching you today, and you got put into the YouTube jail.
Oh, yeah, we're back in YouTube prison.
Yeah, tell them why. Thanks, an interview we did in July of 2021.
Right, with Ken Cuccinelli, the former VA of the former AG of Virginia, because we were talking about election integrity. So somebody got around to flagging it, and so we're back in the gulag.
It's so ridiculous.
The hell with them. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I got a few questions for you. The first one is, as far as soccer goes, it's like watching paint dry, so I have no opinion. But here's what I need your opinion on. What do you think about the new ad for Illinois in the middle of everything when you look at Chicago and all of the mass shootings and shootings of children, the carjackings, the smash and grabs, the chaos in the streets and in the parks? When people look at that, they actually say the ad's right on point. You are in the middle of everything.
Yeah,
we know they don't come to Illinois.
Yeah.
They don't come to Illinois to go to see the Abraham Lincoln Museum. And the second quick thing is the judicial hearings about the abortion access care. They ask a question to this Amy Aran Badi, I think her name is.
Mm-hmm.
They asked, what is a woman? And she said everyone will identify them themselves. And the second thing is, which I thought was ridiculous, can a man become pregnant and have an abortion? And her answer was yes. Wow.
Of course, he's
they're
expecting.
Birthing people. They're not man or woman.
Rich, go watch He's Expecting on Netflix. Educate yourself. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.